Thank you again, Catherine. It's great. So before I move into my material, I want to do something I didn't know I was going to do. The beauty of the stone ceremony, I spent a lot of time with a guy named Stephen Levine and his wife Andrea, who, if you don't know them, they picked up the Body of Death and Dying work from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and worked for many years in the AIDS HIV community while they were dying. And he says, my words for what he says, that we do not in our culture spend enough time bearing witness. We march right past people's losses, right past people's injuries, their grievance that they feel deeply, their sorrow because of their neighbors who are in difficult straits. And so the beauty of a ceremony like this is it's a chance for us to bear witness. And the principle of bearing witness, stolen slightly out of some Native American practices, is we don't do anything because you can't do anything. We bear witness, we be with, we engage with people who have sorrows. And so I was particularly touched by watching that this morning. And it felt like malpractice to not bear witness to your bearing witness, to be really honest. So that said, I'm not going to talk about goats, but I do need to connect a dot back to something that was in my introduction. I do a whole bunch of things, but part of what I want to talk about, this sacred ground notion, actually has to do with more than a decade now spent on the land with people who spend their life on the land, with livestock, with farming, with, you know, all those sorts of things. And the thing that most amazed me, this may surprise some of you, because a lot of that time is spent in very, very conservative political environments. Many people of the land have very, very conservative philosophies, but their love of the land is profound. It is profound. The honor they have, typically because it's been generation after generation of their people on the land. And so one of the things they have taught me is while I have many things that I disagree in very curious ways with them, we share the love of the land, even though the way we approach it is markedly different. Now, that sort of puts me in context. My story really begins a number of years ago in the Utah Red Rock Desert. I was out in a place, it was off season, so even the insects were dormant. And I was fairly off the beaten path. And in that space, I heard silence like I have never heard silence before. It was, as some poets have described it, deafeningly silent. Uncomfortably, disturbingly silent. And what rose up in me was an anxiety from deep within my belly because I had been stripped of all the things that I have bearings to, which is this sensory world. And fortunately, I'd been in the hands of a lot of good teachers along the way, and they had taught me along the way to breathe. And so I breathed into that aching silence. And something opened up. And I don't know if any of you like Emmylou Harris, the musician. She's got a great album title, and the single cutoff of it is Stumble Into Grace. Well, I don't know if it was grace I stumbled into, but I stumbled into something that I would describe today as a mystical experience. I fell into a space in the absence of sound, in the absence of any people, in the absence of anything except blue sky and red rock. And I didn't know what it was, and I didn't know what to do with it, but I knew that I loved the feel of it. Fast forward. I'm living in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm out with a friend in the Sandia Mountains. If any of you don't know, there's the mountain spine that runs just east of Albuquerque. Sandia translates as watermelon, because when the low sun hits it, it shines like the color of the red of a watermelon with little black pockmarks like seeds. So the conquistadores called it sandia because it reminded them of watermelon. And we were out wandering in the wilderness there, and we came upon a cave. Now, you know, we're storytellers, so I would love to tell a story in my head about how we were the first ones ever to find the cave, and, you know, that whole aren't I special thing. And the reality was that it was a...
Some of the people who spent a lot of time in curious places in the Southwest would call it a portal or a thin place. There was a feeling in the cave that was not dissimilar to the feeling of profound silence in the desert. And yet there it was, and I tumbled into it again. And at that point, I'm not sure I knew how to connect the dots. Today, I think I can. Fast forward a little more, I was in Zimbabwe, which, if you don't know, Zimbabwe is one of the most diminished settings around the globe because of their despot ruler, Mugabe. It's fallen apart. I was actually not there to do things economically. I was there to look at how they use animals in their culture, the Shona people. And so I had the most amazing experience. We were out, they were teaching me what they do, because I'm ignorant about agricultural things. I'm a suburban guy. But they took me out and they showed me their pig herd, their swine herd. And I was blown away. So here's, if you can imagine, probably 30 herders, full-time job is to move their swine herd. And by the way, in Africa, animals are valuable to you. It is your community wealth. So they've got 70, 80, 85, 85 of these animals. And you would never guess it from eating things like bacon and pork chops, but an animal on the land does not have any fat on it. They were lean, they were tough, they were foragers, and this herd, protecting them from predators, the herders just took them along, and I got to walk with them for a while, and they taught me a little bit about what they do. And there was something about that experience that changed my perception. But it was the next morning that I stumbled into this thing again. When I got up early, I was drinking some very, very strong English tea that morning. I was out. I was the first one up because I had jet lag and everybody else had adjusted. And so I was gazing out. And Zimbabwe is actually a fairly dry country, but in the wet season, it's got a lot of green. It's a very short period, but it's green, and then it all goes away because it dries up again. So I'm gazing out into the green. So here I am. Thousands of miles from the silence in the desert, thousands of miles from the cave in the Sandia Mountains, I'm looking at this green mass. I've been doing a pig herd thing the previous day, which seems anomalous, but it set the scene for stumbling into that space again when the green parted and I felt or saw something that was the same thing, but somehow different. The mystics might call it presence. Somewhat like Eckhart Tolle might call it the now. Walt Whitman wrote a whole poem about this, Song of Myself, placing himself in the context of this mystical experience. Some thought he was crazy. Some others believe he was talking about a mystical experience, a stumbling into the presence of the divine, or for those of you who are agnostic in this congregation, stumbling into whatever that thing is that we don't know what to name and don't know how to describe. And I remember saying to myself, there's a pattern here, Ron, in totally dissimilar settings. So a few weeks later, I was living in Albuquerque, New Mexico at the time. A few weeks later, I'm walking down Lead Avenue toward downtown because I'm doing some work down there. Now, if any of you know Albuquerque, Lead Avenue is the antithesis of all that I just described for you. It is asphalt, it is adobe, it is brick, it is cars. You're just less than half a mile from downtown Albuquerque. And I'm walking down a broken sidewalk on a spring day, and all of a sudden, my environment lights up. Like, there it is. I don't know, some might call it an aura. I have no idea. I'm just telling you what happened to me. And it had the same feel as the feel in the desert, as the feel in the cave, as the experience in the greenery in Africa. And I said to myself, I don't know what this means, but there's something important here. That's the realm of the sacred. And to connect back to what Wendell Berry and Terry Tempest Williams had to say, they both are pointing us, like so many of the mystics, like so many of the philosophers have done, they're pointing us to the presence of the sacred, the presence of a sanctuary in any place, any time, any space. They're telling us that it is ever with us, that we bring the sacred with us. that it's not contingent on this structure, although you've turned this into a beautiful structure. It's not contingent on the seat you're sitting in. It's not contingent on the goat herd out there. It's contingent on what we bring to the space within which we find ourselves. Now, the reason that's so important for a congregation that is interested in being a green sanctuary, which I think all of you know that you're engaged in that, right? Hopefully you all know that. You're engaged in that. Is that it alters the way we view what it is to be a green sanctuary. Ken Wilber, the great American philosopher, he's not dead yet, so someday he'll be great. Ken Wilber says that our task, as we grow in our own consciousness and development, our task is not to reject, but to transcend and include all that has come before it. And he goes on to say that the challenge for people who begin to become conscious about things like green practice is their tendency then to condemn those who have not yet arrived at that place. Essentially, we look down upon our nose at people who don't see it the way we see it, whether that's because we're a vegetarian and all those other enlightened, unenlightened carnivores won't stop eating meat, or whether it's, and I'm speaking a little bit glibly here, because we're humans. This is not judgment. This is what we do, right? And so what we do is we take some place, I was up in Nova Scotia last year and had a chance to get out and see some of the terrain just outside of the city north of Halifax, and was just blown away by the beauty, just blown away. And the mistake I made is I came back to the city of Halifax thinking I had just been in the sacred. And I left the sacred behind because I didn't understand at that moment that the sacred that was there was also in the driving rainstorm in the middle of Halifax that I was walking through under an umbrella that kept uninverting itself. Inverting itself, right? Blowing out, right? Because I was out there in that glorious space. Part of that was having seen Maude Lewis's. If you don't know Maude Lewis's story, she's a Canadian treasure. She was born in the hinterlands of Nova Scotia with some physical deformities. Eventually had a very, very bad case of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. She had no formal training. She's a primitivist from an artistic point of view. But my God, what that woman captured in her paintings is heart-achingly beautiful. Simple, but heart-achingly beautiful. And I remember I wrote a piece about this. It's like, man, if you can be born into the wilderness of Nova Scotia with physical impairments, no training, no artistic materials, and paint like that, anything should be possible. I should not be limited by space. Why should we? The sacred is with us everywhere, including within us. And yet the challenge I think we all find ourselves with is we see something or go someplace, we have an experience, we reach a level of awareness, something changes in us, and then what we humans do, it's how we've evolved. If you trace our evolutionary path, some of you are probably evolutionary biologists in here, they float around UU circles. That's what we do. We're like, we take stuff, the word for it is we reify it, we take it, we say it's a this, and we move on. So what we do is we go to a cave in the Sandia Mountains and say that is holy ground. And then we come back to the city of Albuquerque and we say this is not holy ground. That's a fatal flaw in my thinking. It's a fatal flaw in my tendencies. It underlies my judgment of people. It underlies my judgment of all kinds of practices. I was a little bit chuckling to myself when Ron was telling me some of the history here, that this was formerly a Baptist environment with a big baptismal font. And I caught myself wanting to judge the Baptists, right? Because they aren't as enlightened as the UUs, right? I caught myself doing that. I didn't tell Ron that, but that's what's going on in my head, right? They're not part of the sacred, right? It's what we do. It's human. It's nothing to be judged, it's simply to be acknowledged, because lots of the great mystics and spiritual teachers tell us that when we bring our blocks in our eyes out into the light, they dissolve in the sunlight as if shadowy. They aren't real, but they're stuck in us. So where that takes me to is this continuing experience I have. I could tell you the story. They're just endless stories of places I have been, conversations I have had, where I stumble into the sacred, never knowing it was there. I just did it earlier when I said, I talked about my abiding love for the goat herd, right? It's It's like, well, see, the sacred is out there with the goat herd, right? No, it's not. That happens to be a place, a portal for me to experience the sacred, to experience the divine as I understand the divine. But then what happens is I make the tragic mistake of then coming back to whatever space I started from or whatever space I am returning to and feeling the discouragement that comes from having left the sacred behind. I become disappointed, which is not a useful trait, actually. It's human, but it's not useful. So the test then becomes this question of, so, and here's where the work gets hard. This is usually where I should tell you that I have an abiding affection for UU communities, because someone always comes up afterwards and tells me the things I was not thinking about when I spoke about what I spoke about. It's one of the things that makes UU communities, I would tell Ron about this, I woke up this morning like trying to go through the logic trail. Okay, how can I lay this thing down? But then it's like, nah, someone's going to come up afterwards and say, you know, Ron, you need to think about bang, 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 bang. And they'll be right, and I'll need to fold that in too. So the challenge for us becomes, how do we bring the sacred with us? That's a challenge. When you get into what Terry Tempest Williams called the brokenness, or into the space that Wendell Berry called the desecrated, how do we bring the sacred with us into that space? That's hard work, because we want to judge it. We want to, I mean, if you all are like me, and I do this all the time, we want to like put it over there and say, no, that's not it. Now, what's interesting is when you talk in UU communities, what often happens as you start talking about treating it all as sacred is someone will inevitably suggest to me, well, are you suggesting we just let it all be the way it is? So we just have to like not intervene? We don't take social action? That's not what that means. It means that the action you take, and I know you do because you're a UU community, the action you take is out of sacredness, not out of rejection. And that changes everything. I was doing this at a UU in Colorado, as I recall, and I was talking about that thing we do. She was a teacher, fifth grade teacher. She came up afterwards. We were talking about that thing that is such a challenge, which is to not judge, to not put conditions on people or places, circumstances, terrain, to not do that. And she came up and she said, Ron, you're right. When I am judging my kids, it always goes worse than when I'm not judging my kids. There it is. Same thing happens when we judge landscape. If I were to tell you right now that I could bring in a small herd of sheep, and I could put those sheep over here on your, I looked at this morning, I could keep them for a short period of time out on your lawn over here, and I could graze them for just the right amount of time, and I could take them off the land and observe when the land is ready, and I could bring them back, and I could run it through three cycles, and that lawn there would be more fertile and vibrant than any other lawn in this city. And you would say, I don't think I believe that. Sheep are not good. Well, actually, turns out that sheep are a beautiful solution to the land. A little bit of a pre-look at what we're going to talk about tonight. Do you know why we have the Great Plains, all that land west of the wet country from Iowa west? Because at one point in time, that grassland coexisted with something like 400 million grazing animals. 400 million grazing animals. 90 million bison, probably 100 million antelope, mule deer, wild goats, elk. Did you know that elk actually used to live on the prairies? They've been driven into the mountains because we've killed them off in the prairies. The reason those grasslands exist is because the grass co-evolved with 400 million grazing animals. Cows and sheep are grazers. If you put them on the land in the right way, they'll bring the grass back. All those bare spots go away. Diversity increases. Vitality uptake. The amount of organic matter in the soil goes up dramatically. All the little critters in there, the billions and billions of little critters in the soil, the first millimeter, they proliferate. The grass roots get bigger and bigger, and then when you trim the grass or it gets eaten off, the grass roots die and they store carbon in the soil. One biologist says if we could just bring the grasslands back in Australia, it would mitigate all the increasing global climate change concerns, all of them, just Australia alone. Grass, dirt. Who knew that your lawn was sacred ground? It's how we see it that makes it sacred. It's not what's on your lawn. It's not the bugs in the dirt. They're all part of the sacred, just like you and me. The best thing you could do for that in the absence of sheep is for all of you to go out after every congregation with spikes on your shoes and scuff the heck out of that lawn. It would bring it back, just like hooves. Just like, well, you would have to bring in some imported manure because you wouldn't be defecating on the lawn. At least you're probably not that enlightened. I imagine kids, what are they doing? Okay, I'm sorry, that was bathroom humor. So the sacred is in the seeing, it's in the understanding, it is not what is there. We bring sacred to it, we find the beauty within. We look upon the land around Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which was used as a bombing site that is devastated. We do not look upon that as desecrated. We look upon that as land to be brought back. It remains sacred despite the evidence. And when we treat it like that, it comes back. You can put 30,000 cattle on that bombed out landscape, and within 3 years, it will be a glorious grassland. Cows in the desert, who knew? So much for us to learn and bring to this. But I want to close by making one segue that I actually want to leave you with, because I think I'm just about on time. The problem with being a speaker is you start thinking it's all about you and you go on and on and on, and I don't like doing that because you all don't want to listen that long. Even the best speakers can't hold people for more than about 22 minutes. So, except for Colin Powell, by the way. Colin Powell could hold an audience for 40 minutes because he's such a good storyteller. It's remarkable. One year, I was out on a, what do we want to call it, on a spiritual retreat with some folks. And the spiritual teacher gave us an assignment during the course of that weekend. This was out in the Manzano Mountains in New Mexico. The spiritual teacher gave us an assignment. It was a mini vision quest, if you will, where we were to go out on the land, and we were crossing cultures, so we were taking our little Tibetan prayer circles with us, because she'd given us those. So we were taking that and our little Tibetan emblems to create the sacred space. And we were to go find a place out in the wilderness and create our sacred space, adorn it with what we wished, and then stay in our sacred space for a day and let the sacred find us. That was the assignment. So we came back and we're all talking about these wonderful things, and a friend of mine named Art comes back and he kind of sheepishly goes, man, I couldn't sit still. So I wrapped my sacred circle around me and I walked the earth all day long. And everybody kind of looks at him like he broke the rules. And the teacher looks and goes, and what was your experience? And he said, I had a sacred day everywhere I went. That's the moral. He took his designated sacred device, this Tibetan twine, he wrapped it around him, it's going to make me cry, so that everywhere he walked for a whole day was sacred for him. Now, while you all may not want to wrap yourselves in Tibetan twine as you go about Hendersonville, the principle applies. Sacred ground is where you are. The question for you is how you will bring that attitude, that perspective, that seeing, that reverence, that awe, that inspiration, that awareness with you. Yes, even when you're driving out of this parking lot in your 2013 shiny new car. Because the car's got to be sacred too. In Alcoholics Anonymous, they have a great line. The line is, and this is where they're coming to make a decision that they're going to turn their lives around. That line is, either God is everything or God is nothing. What is our choice to be? If I shift that just slightly for your purposes and say, the sacred is everything or it is nothing, what will your choice be?